So it's my pleasure to chair the next section. It's also a pleasure to see so many people wearing different hats in the same room and moving towards a discussion in the afternoon of how to achieve comprehensive care. So I have the distinguished the honor of introducing the next three speakers, first of which is Dr. Ciccardi, Marco Ciccardi, who's a professor at Luigi Seiko University in Milan, but that only speaks to part of it. He's been absolutely instrumental in shaping the landscape of HAE internationally, both on a molecular level, but he also sees things through a very big lens. He's also been involved, a couple more things. Marco has been involved in the NRBDO back, I think, since some of the early meetings. Those have been published. He's also been very active in supporting us internationally with our Canadian guidelines back to their inception over 15 years ago. So it's my pleasure to turn the microphone over to Marco to hear how an international flavor, how they have shaped their comprehensive care and their care of HAE patients, what we might learn from that, and then how to apply it in our healthcare system. Marco.
Thank you, Stephen, and of course it's a pleasure for me to come back to Toronto. Now it's, I don't know, this may be the third or the fourth visit here in Canada. And it's always a pleasure because I'm really impressed by how much you care about organizing things in general for healthcare. And the other thing that surprised me is that you invited an Italian or Italy to talk about organization. Everybody knows that Italian can really do good things, but when you put together 10 Italians, they're doing a mess. That's what you can easily see from the situation of our country. But anyway, let's see if HAE might be a little bit of an exception to this. And one thing that I'd like to do is just to introduce, the bottom one, yes. So just to remind you, you know what HAE is, but just to remind you a little bit about the symptoms, because there is what characterizes HAE is the variability, and this is the main problem that we have when we trying to treat this patient, and even more when we try to organize the treatment. So HAE, you know, it's a lethal disease because we can have edema in the throat. So it's a paroxysmal disease. So we have symptoms and then we have people who are doing perfectly well. And this moves from one side to place to the other without any understandable reason. And this is what makes the difference. And then we have people who have excruciating pain for abdominal edema, and edema within the bowel that creates temporary bowel obstruction. So people are vomiting, people are having severe pain, and then we have the face of these people that is completely different from their normal look. And of course, you cannot have any social life when you are in a situation like this lady is. The other point, which is characteristic of HAE, is that it's true that is a disease that can be lethal. But on the other side, each of these attacks reverts to normal completely. So it's not a disease that leaves a residual disability. And this is very different compared to other diseases we've been hearing about today, especially hemophilia or the other disease, where the more attack you have, the more chance you have to end up with a permanent disability. HAE is not like this. can be extremely severe, but if you go through the attack safely, then you revert to normal. So this creates some problem when you treat, because when you treat patients, you always have to balance the good and the bad of therapies. There is no therapy which cannot be somehow harmful. So you have to think carefully about what's happening. So just to frame HAE within the general topic of angioedema, you have to think about the angioedema as a symptom, which is the one which I just showed to you. and to the fact that these symptoms frequently goes along with wheals. So there is a component of urticaria, and we know that urticaria is an extremely common symptom, and it affects probably, I don't know if it is 30% of the population as one symptom of urticaria during life. And even angioedema within this setting is very common. But when we talk to the angioedema, I've shown you before, this that comes up with the different, with the three location and the other things, this is rare. It is a rare disease. So we have to distinguish these two settings and make sure that we do not take the angioedema we will talk about with the angioedema that is part of the chronic urticaria, which is common, or which is part of the acute reaction that can be allergic as a mast cell mediator, or can be pseudoallergic as the reaction that we have when we take an anti-inflammatory drugs and we get an allergic reaction. So this is something which is different, and this is what we're going to cover today. We talk about those recurrent angioedema that are without urticaria, and that can either respond to antihistamine, so being sometimes histaminergic, and this is something which is similar, although has not the urticaria component, or can be non-histaminergic, and these are the more complicated and the one that I like the best. So when we talk today about angioedema, and this angioedema that I've shown, so the one that are without urticaria, we have to distinguish several different situations, because now we have different forms of angioedema. So we have the one which is allergic, which is histaminergic and is due to the release of the granules from the basophils or the mast cells, and this is fairly clear. And then we have other forms of angioedema that are acquired. So there is no family history in these patients, or sporadic, you can use the term that you prefer. And for some of those, we have the C1 inhibitor deficiency, which is not due to genetic, but which is due to the presence of a lymphoma. And the lymphoma creates antibody. This is a well-known possibility to have C1 inhibitor deficiency, or probably it can bind C1 inhibitor, or maybe C1 and consuming C1 inhibitor. This is not totally clear. But no matter which one is the mechanism, then it ends up increasing the bradykinin, and the bradykinin creates angioedema for a series of mechanisms. I'm not going into the details today. Then we have an angioedema which is still acquired and which is iatrogenic because it's due to the use of ACE inhibitors. The angiotensin-converting enzyme that these drugs inhibit accumulates bradykinin because it's a potent inactivator of bradykinin. It discharges the bradykinin and makes an inactive peptide. And then we have a group of these angioedema that we do not know yet. We call them idiopathic. We know nothing about. In some of these patients, we were able to show that if you take blood from a forearm with angioedema and compare with the forearm without angioedema, you can show that the bradykinin is higher in the place where you have the angioedema, and this does not happen when you take blood from patient who has an histaminergic angioedema, which is an angioedema that does not recur if you put this patient under treatment with antihistamine. Then we have the hereditary angioedema. And also in the hereditary angioedema, now we have a very good variety of situations. So we know the fact that this angioedema is usually mediated by the increase of bradykinin. I'm not aware of hereditary angioedema due to other mediators, although it's certainly possible to. I don't know about histamine. I've never heard about it. But the most common and the best described one is the one which is due to the C1 inhibitor deficiency, and in this case is because we have a mutation in a C1 inhibitor that can prevent the protein from being produced, or that can create a situation where the protein is produced, but actually does not function. So it's a dysfunctional protein which is made. Then we have an angioedema which is due to factor 12 mutation. So this has been described in 2000 and in the first as an angioedema that has normal C1 inhibitor. And then within this group of angioedema that have normal C1 inhibitor and that at that time for some time had been called as angioedema HAE type 3 that created a good confusion, this fact of this name of type 3, then the first group that has been identified to have a genetic defect is the group with factor 12 mutations. And after 10 years, it has been clarified last year that this mutation in factor 12 affect a region where there is a glycosylation site, and the mutation creates a situation where the factor 12 is susceptible to cleavage by plasmin. And because of that, we have an increased amount of factor 12 that is formed, and then we have angioedema because the factor 12 cleaves kallikrein and high molecular weight kininogen and generates bradykinin. Then this here, I get confused with up and down. The other type of angioedema that has been described among hereditary and the other mutation that has been described this year is a mutation in angiopoietin. This is interesting because it's the first time that we have a mechanism of angioedema which goes outside from the contact system, at least for the beginning. Because the angiopoietin 1, when it is mutated, apparently does not create the polymers as it does the normal angiopoietin 1. And when the polymers have not made, and angiopoietin 1 stimulates its receptor as a single molecule, this receptor is not stimulated enough to start with the intracellular signal. And since the intracellular signal of the angiopoietin receptor, which is the type 2 receptor on the surface of the endothelial cells, if it doesn't work, it does not inhibit the pathway which is triggered by VEGF or this receptor for bradykinin. And therefore, it creates susceptibility to angioedema, or at least we think it does. Of course, it needs to be proved. And a few months later, Konrad Borg has shown that there are mutations in the plasminogen gene that are associated with hereditary angioedema and segregate with hereditary angioedema. So now we have a good array of mutations that we know create angioedema. And when we go to the diagnosis of this, we have now the first problem. So we have to diagnose these forms properly. And we can diagnose hereditary angioedema based on the reduced function of C1 inhibitor. And we have the acquired the hereditary, and in the hereditary one, we have to do some additional tests because we have to show that there is a consumption of the classical pathway of complement, and the fact that this is mainly done by autoantibodies to C1 inhibitor, and therefore we can make a proper diagnosis. When we have we go to the angioedema, hereditary angioedema or acquired angioedema with normal C1 inhibitor, we have to go in order to make the diagnosis. If we have hereditary, we have to genotype for factor 12, for angiopoietin, and for plasminogen today. So we have more tests to create. And when we go from acquired, of course, that's easier because they either take ACE inhibitor or we do not know nothing about those, and we still without a clear evidence for the disease. And for all these angioedema, unfortunately, today we have therapies just for C1 inhibitor deficiency. So when we move to treatment, we exclude all this part of angioedema and this type 3. We have no evidence that this is one of the main things we have to think about for the future, and that is our task for the future. Moving to the treatment. So the treatment is just for C1 inhibitor deficiency. And it is quite well defined, the approach to the treatment. And the approach to the treatment is based on the on-demand. So you treat when the patient has the attack, or when the patient is going to have an attack because it is exposed to a risky situation like endotracheal intubation, the edema at frequently triggered by microtrauma, and therefore it's easy that the patient may have an angioedema if the larynx is somehow traumatized by the tube for the intubation. Or if the patients are sick, you can go to the long-term prophylaxis. So this is clear. What is not clear is how do we move from this to this and from this back to here. This is fairly well defined, so that's not a big problem. But the other is a big problem, and this is what we've been struggling, and is the central problem when you treat patients. Also because nowadays the treatment of a long-term treatment with the new drugs cost something that in Europe is about the €200,000 per patient. In US is as usual 4 or 5 times more than that. And the other point is that we have drugs that have side effects that may have a similar effect at €100 per year. So it's difficult when you have to deal with this. And I think that this is the central problem today for HA. When do we have to use this treatment? So the drugs that are available are those. So we have plasma-derived C1 inhibitor for hemophilia. We have, of course, it changes the protein, but the principle is the same. And then we have a drug that blocks the receptor for bradykinin. In Italy, we don't have a Kalantide, which is an inhibitor of kallikrein and a recombinant inhibitor of kallikrein, and this treatment is used in US, is registered in US. When you go to prophylaxis, you can use the androgen, which is an old treatment that has been used from the 70s until recently. Or you can have a repeated infusion of C1 inhibitor. And when we come to prices, we see that this one treatment is about €1,500. And when you go to this, is the one I was talking about. So this is about €100 per year, and this is about €200,000 or so. So how do we manage to treat the patient properly and to get them? So these are the guidelines. We talk about guidelines today. We heard about guidelines today. And guidelines are very clear on how to approach the patients. So you have to give the patient with a drug that prevents the death. So you have to give the patients a treatment that they can administer at home. Self-treatment is highly promoted in HAE as in other chronic diseases because of the advantage, and you all know what are the advantages. Then the other point is that the attack has to be treated at the beginning. And this is obvious, but it's not easy to have with patients because many patients, they tend to delay the treatment for a series of reasons, and we may come back on this. And then you have to calculate the advantage and the disadvantage of the disease and of the treatment. And this, I think, is the critical point, to calculate the burden of the disease. And this is immediately going to the last point, which is to switch a patient on prophylaxis. So a patient is on demand, and it's obvious that everybody has to have the on-demand treatment. But when you have to switch from the on-demand, because the on-demand does not control the treatment, the disease, to the prophylaxis. So there has been several papers, there have been a lot of work which has been done about the fact that of the self-administration, and there are no questions about the advantages, both from the efficacy of the drug and the fact that this provides the patient with the freedom that any patient has to have. So no questions about this. About burden of the disease, that's a problem. It's a problem. So we have the disease course and early onset, and there are several factors that may actually impact on this burden. But it's difficult to define this factor because we don't have many data. So we have the attacks, the unpredictability of the attacks, and the effect that this unpredictability of the attacks create on the subjects. Then we have other points like the cost, the quality of life, which is actually the end of everything, and the fact that this treatment may not be always available or easily available. So one of the things we've been working on, that are difficult, is how to assess or we consider the severity, the activity, the quality of life questionnaire, the control of this disease, all this point is not easy. One of the things that has been done, which is usual, is to have diaries for the patient. But get a patient filling the diary, it's really difficult. And get all patients filling the diary is even more difficult than that. So disease score. There have been many attempts to come up with a disease score, considering the different components. So on one side, you have the attacks. On the other side, you have the impact of attacks. But as I was telling you, it's difficult to come up with a single score. And today, we do not have a single score which is universally accepted for HAE. And this is one of the points. Then we have the evaluation of the quality of life. I'm sure that you know a lot more than I do on this, and you know what are the problems of the quality of life questionnaires, the fact that you have to validate within a specific disease. And some of these questionnaires, they come from other disease and they're adapted. The other point of the questionnaire is a transnational validation, which is an additional problem that has to be done because the life is not the same in one country and the other. So you have to adapt this. And this is the other point that we've been dealing with. So in the end, what are at present the main limitations that we have in order to follow the situation? So the instruments are generic. Usually they're not adapted to children. There are few data from the patients, and there are even less data coming from the real life. And it's so the results are difficult to be interpreted, and there is the need for extending the validation of these results. And that we have things that change. So if we go back when treatment were not available, we have certain data. If we come back now, we have different data. So we need to have these things moving, and this is one of the problems. So let's say what happened in Europe, just quickly. In Europe, we started doing something on angioedema in the 70s, and we had just a few centers working on angioedema at that time. We learned a lot from hemophilia, and the first association that was established in Italy is because we're in the same department of an hemophilia group, a big hemophilia group. And then there have been other groups coming up in Europe. Now we have in most European countries this. And so we had a grant from a European community in order to work on HAE. In Italy, we created centers from HAE that are all over Italy and with the aim of establishing therapy and the aim of establishing guidelines. We gave a prevalence, a minimum prevalence in Italy, which is 1 to 65,000. Of course, we don't have all the patients, but these are the patients who are proved to be having HAE. We had regional guidelines for HAE that define the use based on the rules. We have the medical certificates for people who are diagnosed, and we have patients' card and a phone number that people can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Then we have educational problems in all centers for self-infusion and for availability of drugs. And we have recognition from the regional government for these centers. Something has changed, but still we do not come up with a good number of treatments done in the early phase of the disease. We improved in terms of treating attacks on demand. We had just a tiny amount back, and now we're about more than 60%. And then we come to the last point, the registry. So we have few data, and this, I think, is the main problem that we have in angioedema. So we develop a registry with different aims. Of course, monitoring patients, monitoring the quality of care, and expanding the knowledge. And the registry is based on centers and with a steering committee and with sponsors of this, because it's essential. The type of information that we get into this register are the usual and the demographic that depict the disease. And we have to report the diagnosis for each single form of angioedema in order not to include in this registry diseases that are not exactly precisely diagnosed. We have to record the concomitant disease because we do not the natural history of the disease. And we have to record the prophylaxis in these patients. And the most important part is that we will have to record each single attack. Now it's done on paper, and it will be done on an app, and the treatment of each single attack in order to provide enough data to move on, and then to provide statistics other than data for the single patient. And we want to use this register to move a little bit ahead from this. And the holistic approach. The holistic approach, when you look at things, you have differences. But when you look at things more carefully, you think that you have also a lot of things that are exactly the same. And the differences, where do they come from? From little things, like a mutation. But a single mutation then goes on to a huge amount of varieties. We have the epigenetics. We have the RNA regulation, we have the protein manipulation, so many things that in the end, in order to define the difference between these two individuals, you really have to record data in all these parameters. So the approach that we want to have is to collect data, as many data as possible, and to analyze these data connected into the single registry. And the data that we want to capture are data from the variability of the disease, the clinical variability, the biochemical variability, and the genetic variability. And then what we want to capture is to help the quality of life questionnaire to have data from the physiologic variability of people recording. Now it's easy to do this. And this data can be used in order to analyze this data and do something that could be something which might be close to the big data analysis in order to obtain significant data that we're now looking at. So, and these are the people, and this is the Ithaca group. This is Professor Agostoni, who started the HAE in Italy, and this is our group in Milan. Thank you.